Welcome, friends. This is Red Eyes Radio. Good to have you all with us, regular and new listeners. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from Göteborg in Sweden. It's good to have you all with us today. I hope you are comfortable wherever you are in the world and ready for another interesting radio program. Our website is redicecreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. There's where you can go to hear, see, and read more about what we do. Check out our busy news section on a myriad of topics, important and interesting news from around the world and beyond. And if you like the radio program, check through our radio archive. We have a year of program for you up there to download for free. If you want to have more and want to get access to all the second hour of our interviews and our entire radio archive going back to 2006, sign up for a membership with us, and you'll also get full access to our video interviews, webcasts, films, and much more. And today we are going to talk about vampires, the real kind, if you will. We're going to talk about psychic vampires and psychic vampirism with our guest Joe H. Slate. He is a licensed psychologist in private practice with a PhD from the University of Alabama and postdoctoral studies in hypnosis and psychosomatic medicine at the University of California. He is a emeritus professor. Don't know if I pronounced that correctly. We can ask Joe about that later on. Emeritus professor of psychology at Athens State University and honorary professor at the University of Montevallo. His research interests include health and fitness, rejuvenation, pain management, reincarnation, astral projection, and the human aura. His research has been funded by the U.S. Army, the Parapsychology Foundation of New York, and numerous private sources. He's also a member of the American Psychological Association and a platinum registrant of the National Register of Health Service Providers in Psychology. And he is the founder of the International Parapsychology Research Foundation and author of several books, including Beyond Reincarnation, Psychic Vampires, Aura Energy for Health, Healing and Balance, and also Rejuvenation. So with that, welcome to Red Eyes Radio. Joe, thank you very much for coming on the program today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
It's really interesting hearing about your background. It's wide, and you've been into a lot of different topics. And before we tonight here dive into the main topic of psychic vampirism, I'd just like to know maybe if you can tell us a little bit more about your background in terms of where the different areas you've been involved in. Among other things, the U.S. Army has been interested in your work and so forth. Maybe you can let us know what were they interested in regards to your research. Have they been into psychic vampirism, or is there other areas that they are primarily interested in, Joe?
Thank you. My interest in psychic vampires began many, many years ago. I was born and raised here in the Deep South in the U.S., and I had a interest in psychic vampires beginning actually as a preschooler. I think that's partly due to the fact that I had a family member, in fact, a great aunt, who herself had some of the symptoms of psychic vampirism, or what we would better call energy vampirism. It became quite obvious when she would visit us on more or less a regular basis, but especially on cold winter evenings where we had a roaring fire in the fireplace. We would sit around the fireplace, and it was always difficult to keep a fire going when she was present, and everyone began to suspect that she was drawing some kind of energy from the fire, though we had no strong evidence to support that. I know that sounds a little strange to your listeners, but I will have to add that it did not just end there. She believed that she would live forever. I give this account in my book. She believed that she would live forever, and she spent much of her life traveling the world looking for the secrets of rejuvenation. And while traveling in a certain European country, she was given an emerald by one of the rulers. This was many, many years ago. And she wore this mind emerald constantly as a pendant, and would periodically stroke that stone. I remember as a toddler asking her, why did she stroke the stone? And she would always reply, well, I get energy from it. I finally asked, well, why does the fire seem to die down when you're present? She said, well, I draw energy from that as well. So I admired her greatly. She was a brilliant woman. She lived alone. She had several young men always in her attendance. And I suspected, even as a child, that she may be drawing energy from them as well. So one day I became bold enough to ask her if she was gaining energy from those young men. And she turned to me rather condescendingly and said, "My child, how else could I live forever?" Well, that was enough to pique my interest in energy vampirism,
I'd say.
So that's how it all started. I want to quickly add, though, one of the critics of my book suggested that I had hostility for this aunt. Actually, I had great admiration of her, and she was certainly an inspiration in my life. But she had a rather deep understanding of energy vampirism, and she practiced it. She lived to be well beyond 100. It was uncertain as to what the age was when she finally crossed over during her sleep. But I just have to throw that in as one of the most interesting experiences of my life. I certainly had no way of knowing that upon completing my doctorate at the University of Alabama, one of the first studies I would do had to do with Hurlian photography and measuring or attempting to measure the energy system enveloping the physical body, and then discovering as we went along that it is a transferable energy in a both positive and negative sense. So that's how it all got started.
Really interesting. And by the way, do you know from whom she got that stone, the emerald that you mentioned?
I do not know. That was always a mystery. She was never really concise regarding that, but we did know that she visited a province in northern, in fact, it was in India. I understand that she visited a northern province, and this would be back in the 1920s, I believe.
Hmm.
And it was there that she established a school. She was quite wealthy, and she did a lot of humanitarian kinds of, she headed a lot of those humanitarian projects, and it was there she established a school and was given by the ruler, I understand. Now, this is not recorded anywhere, but I understand that she was given this mined emerald. It was a very large emerald that she always wore about her neck. And it was given to her with the claim that she would be able, if she would wear that emerald, to draw rejuvenating energy from it. So she wore it throughout her life.
That's really
interesting. I might add that in a follow-up study I did while a student at the University of Alabama, during my graduate studies there, I did a study inspired by my great aunt. I did a study on rejuvenation in which I interviewed centenarians and, well, actually people in the 90s, in their 90s and beyond. And one of my subjects during the interview wore as a pendant an emerald, and throughout the interview she stroked the gem periodically. When I came to the question, which was included in my interview, what is your favorite stone, she looked at me and said, "Young man, need you ask? The emerald, of course." And then she said it was a helpful stone, and that it was a gift from her husband, then deceased, I should say. It was a gift of her husband, and when she stroked the emerald, she always felt his presence. He, incidentally, in fact, they were both retired professors at the University of Alabama, a very articulate woman who was convinced that the emerald she wore was a source of the energy that helped her stay in better health and actually rejuvenated her, as well as connecting her in a very positive way to her husband who had crossed over many years earlier.
So if we maybe can break down a little bit of the terminology and basically define the term psychic vampirism, and you've given us a little bit of a clue here to where this is going, of course, but tell us a little bit more about how we would classify or define the term psychic vampirism.
First, this is a term that's often misunderstood. It's often seen as a very negative kind of condition where a very evil person taps into the energies of a host victim and draws energy from it to replenish his own lost energy supply. Now, that's only a part of the story. Our studies showed that psychic vampirism exists in many forms and in forms that actually can be measured. It can exist in what we call one-on-one vampirism, where you have a host victim, well, you have the vampire and a host victim, and the vampire does indeed tap into the energy of the host victim and extracts energy. The result is, for the vampire, a strengthening of his or her energy system, but for the victim, a depletion of energy. It's very hard to read anything positive into that kind of interaction.
Yes.
But our studies found that almost everyone, we're going to be a little reluctant to admit this, I know, but almost everyone has vampire tendencies. They don't always act upon them, and they're not always aware that they're actually doing that. And the tendencies have wide-ranging symptoms. But anyway, it's a very common phenomenon, and we call it one-on-one vampirism. By definition, one-on-one vampirism is simply the transfer of energy from a victim to the so-called vampire.
Mm.
It's a very simple process, and we've all experienced it, possibly, from time to time. But that's only one form of vampirism. If you've ever been in a situation, maybe involved in conversation, and suddenly become a little, well, if not frustrated, maybe a little bored. You may have been in a classroom situation where that happened. In fact, I think I've had students who experienced that very thing. But anyway, you began to feel a little fatigued, and you thought, well, you'd like to end this conversation or get out of this situation. There was probably some transfer of energy going on there. But by contrast, you may have been in another one-on-one situation where the conversation actually enlivened you and energized you. You may not have analyzed that as like, I'm spontaneously receiving energy from this person who is so interesting and captivating. You probably did not analyze that, but the effects you were aware of. And so it works that way as well. I'm trying to emphasize here that we're not dealing with some very evil phenomenon that is very, very rare. It's common. And actually, there's a social psychology term that's sometimes used here. It's called our need for social distance. If someone moves in too close to us in a social interaction, what do we tend to do?
Back away a little bit.
Back away. Back away a bit so as to generate a little social distance. In fact, that's a good way of dealing with situations in which you feel you're under a vampire attack. Simply back away. Generate a little distance between you and the so-called vampire.
Hmm.
But anyway, that's only one of the types, one-on-one. Another very prevalent type of vampirism is group vampirism, which of course involves multiple persons as both vampires and victims. And we see that all the time. In fact, it can reach a global level. For example, an organization that vampirizes the globe by polluting it, we would have to call that organizational vampirism or group vampirism. So that's a second major category. We also see it in other forms, organizations that strive for, well, organizations characterized by discrimination and deprivation, are depriving persons of their rights, and it can be wide-ranging kinds of organizations throughout the world. We would have to call those energy vampire organizations. It's my conviction that we all too often these days are vampirizing our globe. We don't back up and ask, what are we doing to this globe? We're drawing from its resources, but we're not replenishing them. We are polluting the globe. We are exhausting its essential resources, and we need to stop if I could editorialize a little here, we need to stop, back up, and realize we do not have a replacement for this globe. And we are inflicting upon the globe through a vampirizing kind of mentality a condition that could result in devastating consequences for not only present but future generations as well.
Well, that's an interesting point, Joe, and I want to return to that a little bit later and talk more about that. If we look at the one-to-one vampirism relationship at the start here, and just basically maybe boil down the fact how this is possible from a scientific point of view, what did you find, and how could this be proven, so to speak, that indeed an exchange of energy takes place between human beings?
Exactly, and that's a very, very important question. Before addressing that, let me state there's a third type of vampirism that often is ignored, and then we'll get back to your question, and that is parasitic vampirism. Now, that condition originates within yourself. For example, if you have a phobia that limits your life and generates fatigue because of this internal condition, it could fear of objects or conditions, situations. There are all kinds of phobias, but a phobia that actually drains you of your energy and induces a very high level, often a prevailing fear, is actually a form of psychic vampirism. The same is true of a very deep inferiority complex that actually just eats away at your energy system. We could call that a form of psychic vampirism. It's a form that most people are not even aware of, and I thought it very important to include it in my book. And as I researched it, I was rather surprised to find that in the mid-1900s, in the classification of abnormal disorders, there was a condition called parasitic vampirism. It was actually a diagnostic category back in the mid-1900s. Mm-hmm. So that is also... imagine how prevalent that condition is. Any high level of anxiety that's persistent, a neurosis, for example, is a form of vampirism, and that's not to place any kind of negative connotation on it, but it's simply to look at the dynamics of these conditions and the effect it has on our total being, including our energy system. So in my book, I attempted to include ways of resolving those problems and offering actually step-by-step procedures where you can deal with those kinds of parasitic conditions. Back to your question, how to measure, I believe, how to measure vampirism, how we did it.
Yes.
In our laboratory, I received funding from, of all places, U.S. Army Missile Research and Development Command to investigate the human energy system. Well, right away, we set up our laboratory. I decided to use the electrophotographic quantitizing device that was developed in Russia by the Curlians back decades ago. I decided to use Curlian electrophotography as a means of measuring the energy system. We knew it would give good photographs, and we used the right index finger pad as the object to be photographed. Right away, a rather interesting thing happened. Over the period of the study, I had literally hundreds of volunteer subjects, most of them university students. Right away, we began noticing that multiple photographs for the same individual generated a kind of signature for that person. Each person has a unique energy system that can actually be measured, and repeated photographs on the same individuals over a long period of time revealed actually a consistency in the electromagnetic energy very similar in consistency to fingerprinting. So we were able to show through, and it's the first time it had ever been shown in the history of the study of energy, I think, that every individual has a unique energy system. It is relatively stable, And it is so stable, in fact, that when all conditions are controlled, you have what we call an energy signature. You are unique. And that led some people to conclude we're actually measuring the energies of the soul, the spiritual makeup of the individual. And that was suspected by the Curlians when they developed that, and by additional resources or researchers. One of my very best friends was Thelma Moss at the University of Southern California, who was also doing the same research. And when we consulted, we found that many of our findings were consistent. But that was a major finding. And we could take that finding, which showed you do have a stable energy pattern that can be measured, then we can subject you to conditions, including stress, or social interaction situations. We could submit you to certain conditions and observe the effect of those conditions on your energy system. And indeed, we discovered that different conditions have different effects on the energy system. Well, we decided to take it a step further and administer to our subjects personality tests that would measure such characteristics as anxiety, depression, a variety of social disorders, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And we found, to our surprise, that certain personality characteristics were also reflected in the energy pattern. Our studies inadvertently showed that some of our subjects, when we photographed their electromagnetic energies, some of them showed a rather unusual condition that we had not previously seen, and it included the constriction of the aura. The aura just seemed to be constricted, and often you would get a shadow effect in the aura that would show tentacles reaching out from the aura. Well, on further study of those conditions, we found those individuals possessed symptoms of psychic vampirism. It was rather amazing that here in a photograph of the energy around your finger pad, we observed a dark area beyond which extended dark tentacles. And then in researching that, we found they had the symptoms of psychic vampirism. I brought in a group of highly advanced, well, I guess you could call them psychics. They were people who read and analyzed the aura, and their readings of the auras of those subjects confined in a very controlled setting, their readings confirmed our results that the vampire, if it had to be relatively strong, but if the vampire trait is there, you would get a shadow effect, a dulling of the energy beyond which extended tentacles. I have to go a step further with that to share with you what I observed. I was at the time doing couples counseling, and I too had mastered the technique, or sort of mastered the technique for viewing the aura. And I began to notice that in couples counseling, where the couple will be seated on a couch in my office, it was not unusual to see their energy systems repelling each other. There would just simply be a barrier between them. And then I began to notice one of them would, and this sounds unbelievable, I know, but it was there visibly, the tentacle reaching out from the aura would go beyond the aura system and actually penetrate the energy system of the partner. And in further study of that phenomenon, we found other, we found through diagnostic testing and so forth, along with electrophotography, we found that condition did exist in situations where relationships were under serious stress. You had a victim who was being vampirized and depleted, and it was unknowing to the couple that that was happening. So we developed what I called empowering programs to build the energy systems of these couples, in addition to working directly on problems in the relationship, we began to offer our subjects certain energizing programs that would strengthen the aura. And we normally don't think in couples counseling situation how critically important it is for each subject to have a very strong, adequate aura.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We found the underlying problem in couples conflicts is what we have to call psychic vampirism.
So
and that's not to be, I'm careful not to be judgmental here, because as I said, this condition probably exists to some degree from time to time in almost any relationship.
Right.
But it was critically important here because it had gone beyond what is typical and had reached a sort of habitual pattern of interacting. But given aura building strategies, if we could call them strategies, they would be step-by-step programs, we noticed a dramatic change in the energies and a dramatic improvement in the relationship.
Right, right. So you mentioned that this is, in one way, then seems to be, in most cases, unconsciously driven by the psychic vampire. Maybe is that an attractor factor too? Why even a couple would get together? Maybe that, for whatever reason, the vampire is attracted to a, so we say, auric field or energetically a little bit weaker individual, which means that they can tap into their energy, so to speak. Or what do you think? How do you think this develops, so to speak?
Yes, that's an excellent point, and we did find that to be true. There are certain personalities that seem to be dependent on the energies of another person or group. There are also individuals in our studies who find they have a need to give energy.
Hmm.
Now, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Why would I have a need to deplete my own energy system by meeting the energy demands of a partner or of a group or of anyone? Why would I have such a need? Well, it could be because you need that sense of nurturing that you might feel by transferring that energy. Or it could be that you're insecure in the relationship, and at a subconscious level, you may be thinking, well, if I energize my partner, I will be more accepted by that partner and more than an object of affection because of what I'm doing for that partner. In dependency relationships, we find this phenomenon very common. A person who overly depends on the approval of a partner can very easily become an unwitting victim of psychic vampirism that takes a serious toll on one's adjustment and sense of well-being. But that's an excellent point. I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yes.
Because that's often overlooked. I think in psychotherapy, we are at last beginning to realize the importance of this phenomenon. And I'd hoped in writing this book, I debated whether to call it psychic vampirism or psychic vampires or give it another title, because I know right away there's sort of a negative connotation to vampires, but I tried to present the book within a context that is both comprehensive and at the same time very practical.
Mm.
And hopefully the book does that. It could be used as I have in the back of the book a 7-day plan for self-development. If our listeners will just turn to those pages, over a period of 7 days, you can emerge with a very powerful energy system. And I'll hasten to add that almost anyone can benefit from that 7-day plan. I've even used it for myself.
There you go. Well, it's really, really important and incredibly interesting hearing about this. And so what do you think, Joe, in terms of, I guess, where this comes from? Is it a function of our biology? I mean, if it's something unconsciously driven that just seemed to happen, is it the human biology, or is it more on a spiritual or soul level that this takes place? What do you think?
I think it's part of our basic makeup as soul beings. I have to read some spirituality into this phenomenon. In fact, in the study of the paranormal, all roads, now this may sound like an exaggeration, but I found that all roads eventually lead to, in one way or another, spirituality.
Yeah.
And I think the early speculation that we may be photographing the life force that energizes our existence as soul beings, I honestly believe that was not too far off from the truth. And I always hesitate to say, oh, at last we have the truth. But we do have the evidence. And I'm very clear that we are in photographing the aura, or in viewing it if we have mastered the skills required to view it. And my book does get into those as well. I think we are actually viewing the life force. Without energy, could we exist?
No.
No. With energy, we exist, but what's the quality of our existence? It varies. We could exist as very powerful soul beings, or soul beings of very great quality, or we could exist anywhere along the continuum. And so I think we are photographing the permanence of our soul being. I think we have within the patterns of the human energy system that we can actually photograph and observe. I think we have in that system the essential elements of the energy that without which we would not exist. Mm. I think the research is that important. It affects everything we do in life. Who could argue with having a healthy energy system? Who doesn't want that?
Mm, right.
And while we do not, as healthy energy systems of our own, we don't transfer our energy directly in a vampire way to a host recipient, we do contribute to the greater good by trying to generate conditions that benefit everyone. I mentioned what we're doing to the globe right now is totally, totally inexcusable. We cannot continue down this road of destruction. We are leaving fingerprints that will be there, not just for our lifetime or the lifetime of our children, but forever. And we must come to the realization that while certain of it is irreversible, we can take steps to correct this deplorable situation. And that, I know, sounds a little extreme, possibly to some of our listeners, but I think it's really time that we seriously look at that. As energy beings, we're here for two purposes. When we look at all of it, we're here only for two purposes: to reach our highest growth potentials. That's why we're here, to learn and grow, and to achieve our highest potentials for that. The second reason is to help others do the same. And we're not doing very good at that second reason. Hmm. It's time that we realize the critical importance not only of developing our potentials that relate to ourselves, but contributing, to use an overused term, contributing to the greater good. And I don't think we can argue with that.
This is something we can return to a little bit later as well, on Joe. But if you don't mind me asking, why was the U.S. Army interested in this kind of research? It seemed a little bit odd that a military faction would be interested in psychic vampirism, right? Or
yes,
right.
And you have raised a question that I don't have all the answers for. I do know that in submitting a contract to the U.S. Army for the study we did with them. Now, we also did a follow-on to that study with the Parapsychology Foundation of New York, which you earlier mentioned. But in terms of that Army project, I just thought that there might be possibilities through a deeper understanding of the energy system. There might be possibilities there that would be relevant to the Army setting. And I did not exactly define those, but among the possibilities, I thought of security applications. And interestingly, we have sort of developed many of those earlier. Now, keep in mind, this study was done in 1977.
Okay, yeah.
So I've been around a few years.
Yes.
And it goes all the way back, and it was conducted in a university setting. Here in Alabama is 1977. And in my proposal, I proposed to the Army the application of electrophotography as a possibility in actually analyzing the energy system enveloping the physical body. And it was in that study that we showed that each individual has a unique system that is relatively permanent. The Army was very interested in that because it suggested possibilities for things like security. You could devise, for example, an entry mechanism of security device that would respond to the touch, to the finger touch of an individual. To take it to another rather extreme level, you could actually develop knowing that the energy system is there and is responsive to certain stress conditions. We know what, for example, overwhelming stress can do to the system. You could develop a monitoring system that could be a wristband or an ear tab or, an extreme level, even an implant that would monitor the emotional state of an individual at a great distance. And so you could actually take it to that level. And I'm not going to speculate on what was done with this information, but I do know that some of our findings were further researched in another secure setting. So it leaves a lot of questions open as to what actually happened on follow-on research. But we did the basic studies, and then I applied them to my practice as a psychologist and applied them in ways that I think actually contribute to the well-being of people everywhere.
Oh, really interesting. So after 77, the military took possibly further research and did their own work on this or employed other universities to continue the studies. But in terms of identification, for instance, if we have a unique and individual energy aura field, could this be used as actually identifying individuals as well if you have a sensitive enough equipment that can measure this?
Absolutely. The possibilities are almost unlimited when you really look at the basic data. It's really amazing at where we could go with this. And some of the directions we could go, and I don't want to sound paranoid with this, but some of the directions we could go could actually be detrimental.
Absolutely.
And I don't, you know, and so we have to look at these findings. But, you know, that's true of all knowledge, I guess. Knowledge, we value knowledge, but we often don't take responsibility with how we use it.
That's right.
Knowledge is empowering, but how you use it is equally as critical as the knowledge itself. And so that is throughout my career as a researcher and college professor, throughout my life, this has been a major concern. And I always included in my courses and in my research the importance of using knowledge for the greater good, whatever that knowledge might be. And it's so easy to take knowledge with tremendous positive potential and pollute it in ways that it can become destructive. This should never interrupt our drive to acquire more knowledge. It just needs to accompany that activity. That's my position.
So did you ever feel, I guess, kind of uneasy about the fact that with the aid of the knowledge that you took forward, the potential is that the military actually used this to develop some kind of weaponry in some case that can be detrimental to those who are subjected to it?
Well, I never felt any dis-ease regarding that because I had the assurance of the people I worked with, although I do not know who this is. I do not know everyone that had access to the information. I always felt very comfortable with the persons I worked with. In fact, I think I can mention this. One of the persons who was a part of the project and was a representative for the Army became extremely interested in our studies and began actually looking at what we were studying as, from his perspective, a very clear, positive manifestation of an energy system with tremendous empowering possibilities. And I felt very comfortable that here was a person who understood, he was in a high ranking with the military, who understood what we were really investigating and the possibilities of what we were discovering. So I felt very comfortable, and I don't have any evidence to suggest that our findings were in any way misused or used in anything other than very productive ways by the Army that funded the study. And let me hasten to add, too, that this was only the first of many studies. And in another study I mentioned before, founded by a New York foundation, we took it even further and began to do past life regression studies. I know a lot of people would be disinterested maybe in that facet of a research, but we thought if we're going to really comprehensively look at our existence as soul beings, then we really need to look at the past lives that we have lived and the relationship to our present existence and try to get a more holistic picture of our being. And in that study, which is in another book I've written called Beyond Reincarnation, we found that, of course, it was impossible to measure the energies of persons living in past lives, but we did find that in this study, we did find that aspects of a past life, including things like your significant activities that occurred in that life and the possibility of the influence of that condition on the evolving soul, we found it to be very clear in the research we're doing. And I know that sounds a little foggy to our listeners probably, no. But we did find a relationship between the electromagnetic energy fields of this present life and the speculative energies of a past life.
Wow.
And so if our readers want to go further, in other words, we're getting at some evidence here of the permanency of the soul.
Yes.
And I concluded that we're the same soul. We have what we call the spiritual genotype, that's the makeup of the soul, that is the same. This was my conclusion from life to life.
Wow.
We don't get a different soul with each lifetime.
Right.
And that's obvious to all of us. We are permanent spiritual beings. But it was also interesting in our studies to find that what happened to us as a soul being in a past lifetime could be passed right on into this lifetime. And an example, there are many examples, but for example, if you fell to your death in a past lifetime, and in this lifetime you're prone to a fear that takes its toll on your energy system, we found that if you get insight into that past life trauma, you can resolve the fear, and your energy system becomes empowered.
Wow, that's just incredible.
I know, this gets a little far-reaching, I know.
But it's really interesting. And Joe, I just want to ask you then, would this potentially mean that if we combine these studies that you found in regards to the energetic imprint of the soul, the identification, so to speak, of the soul, and if you were to develop, well, let's say some kind of energetic database where you actually collect the individual, how to identify a soul, basically, in this database, for instance, then a person who passes on,
right.
You could actually potentially then see that person being born X amount of years later, or however that works. If we're talking about a span of several hundred years in between, we potentially
right.
come back or not. We don't know that, but what you're saying is that we get to potentially see the imprint of that same soul, so to speak, coming back.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And you brought up a point that I've considered and am proposing future research on. Is it possible for a soul that has crossed over to visit this dimension and leave the energy pattern, the energy imprint in a lab setting? if we could do that, for example, if I pass away today and my research colleagues decide, well, we want to be sure he's on the other side now, can we set up the laboratory so he can return and leave his finger energy imprint on the photographic stem we have set up for him? Well, we do electronic voice imprints. We analyze those sounds that we think are from the other side. This would give almost conclusive evidence if we could get an electrophotograph of a ghost. Mm-hmm. We could call it a ghost. Mm-hmm. I don't use that term much. But if we could get the electrophotograph of the person who's crossed over and it matched the one, as I've said, they're relatively stable. If it matched the patterns they left behind, that would be powerful evidence.
Indeed.
That life goes on beyond death and that the soul is the same, that the makeup of the soul is forever. I'm convinced of that already. I think we are a soul. I think our existence is unlimited. We existed before our first incarnation, and we will exist beyond our last. But wouldn't it be nice to have conclusive, substantial, objective evidence that life goes on beyond death?
That's absolutely right. And Joe, maybe we can just briefly talk before we begin to round things up here for the first hour about Carillion photography, and maybe you can just explain to us a little bit how that works, and with kind of catching on from that, did you primarily use this technique, or did you in any regard update it or modify it in order to fit the purposes of what you wanted to discover?
We used the highest technology available at the time, and I did have working with me physicists and actually engineers who worked with us in setting up our laboratory. We had all of the controls required to get the energy measurements we were searching for. And I call them energy measurements. They're sometimes called electrophotographic energy discharges. But it is a process which does require extensive controls, and we used all of those. And I had the assistance of experts in the field to help set it up. So I'm very comfortable with what we found in our research. We were able, for example, this procedure, and I go through all of that in my book, but the procedure does require a control lab setting in which the finger has to rest on the film, in fact, to get the photograph. You have an electric supply, and you have other variables, including the degree of pressure of the film upon the finger and the angle of the finger upon the film. Well, we were able to, and a picture of it is in the book, we were able to devise a laboratory situation in which all of that was controlled. Beyond that, temperature and humidity had to be controlled. And beyond that, the moisture on the finger itself that we were photographing had to be controlled. So all of those were controlled. There was, during our study, an article that appeared in some of the literature stating that Carillion photography is nothing more than the moisture around the fingertip being photographed. Of course, you can use electrophotography to photograph plants and different things. But anyway, we decided, well, we'll control the moisture. And so we did an alcohol wash of the finger, and we air dried the finger before we did the photograph so that the moisture content was controlled. Mm-hmm. We found absolutely no effect of that either, that condition on the aura. And so actually our research disproved a criticism of Carillion photography. It was found not to be influenced. It was found not to be a measure of moisture, but to be a measure of energy, which I connect to our spiritual double.
Very, very interesting, Joe. And I have so many more questions that I want to get to and points and further continue our discussion here, primarily about your book, Psychic Vampirism. But to round things up here for this segment, maybe you can share with us how people can get a copy of your book, Joe. Is it available on Amazon, or do you have it anywhere else where you would like to redirect people who want to pick up a copy?
It is available on Amazon. It's also available through my publisher. My publisher is Llewellyn Worldwide. They have a website. It's llewellyn.com. That's LLEWELLYN.com. The book is available there as well. It's available in bookstores worldwide. The book is, in fact, available in various other languages, including Russian, and should be available throughout Europe. Again, the title is simply Psychic Vampires, and so it should be available in bookstores everywhere. It's also available as a Kindle read, so you can get instant access, almost instant access, through Amazon.
Right, there you go, Llewellyn.com. We will have this link up on our website, redicecreations.com, as well, so you can click through from there easily. But stay with us, Joe, and thank you for this first segment. I'm really looking forward to continue with you more here in our second hour for our members. Red Ice members, more is coming up in our second hour with Joe Slate. We talk about how you can discover if you're a victim of psychic vampirism. Joe talks about self-administered tests and how you can, with a simple technique, see your aura without the use of advanced equipment. We talk about different empowering tools, how you can, as an individual, boost your aura and to help protect yourself from psychic attacks and psychic vampires. We discuss positive transfer of energy versus negative transfer of energy and psychokinesis, how a group can influence physical objects. We talk about other kinds of groups, group vampires like governments, nations, and other organizations. We discuss long-distance thought assault. How does that work, and how can you protect yourself from it? It's also interesting to note again that the military have been interested in this kind of research since at least the end of the 70s. Have they gone further in the research? One wonders, of course, what is available now. A very interesting second hour coming up with Joe Slate for our members. Click on subscribe or sign up from our front page, redicecreations.com, to subscribe and tune in to this and over 400 hours of radio. And we have video material as well. Try it out for 3 months and you'll get access to everything we have up there. You can download it all if you so wish. Stay tuned to Red Ice for much more. We are keeping busy and we'll continue to bring you more free radio. Our first hours are always free. We have Sabina De Vira, Colin Andrews, Sandy Frost, John Harris, and many more joining us soon. And don't forget to sign up for a free weekly newsletter with the links to all the latest material, radio shows, and the latest film and video material. We feature top news of the week, comments from us at Red Ice. We have Earth and space news and so much more. Put in your email at the newsletter banner on our front page. We'll be back with more after this break.